You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Yeah, her name's Brenda Lee. Still waiting on the House to do the final vote on the tax. On the tax legislation. But a lot of smiles on Republican faces. What's going to be interesting is the whole Dreamer thing. To me, look, there's no doubt that there's going to be a deal on that. Because it's the right thing to do for those young people. So that's the next issue. Evidently, that'll be taken up right after the holiday recess in Washington, D.C. I need to I was going to explain something before we went to the break, and now I've forgotten it. Okay, this interview I did yesterday on another show that I do, back into a town where I started doing radio. The program's called Mac Talk. Yeah, Mac Talk. So you're listening to Mac Talk on the All Warrior Radio Network. It got the name. I was going on, and they're like, well, what are you going to call this thing? I'm like, I don't know. And the other guy did a program called Hot Talk. And his producer says, how about Mac Talk? I'm like, that'll work. So that's how it was named. And so I love talking local political issues, local politics. And hopefully in a respectful way, get footnoted discussions with smart people about, complex issues. And then trying to sort through the politics of an issue. To get to the right thing to do. So, anyhow, that's where this interview comes from. So, Ralph Kingsbury is the guy. Ralph served in the United States Army in the mid to late 60s, was in Korea. While Vietnam was ramping up, there's a thing called the Second Korean War that took place between 1966 and 1969 that I never heard about till he mentioned it to me the other day. So I looked it up, and sure shit. It's called the Battle of the DMZ. And I just want to give you some idea of casualties. So give me one second. I'm sorry I should have had this done, but I didn't. Korean DMZ conflict, 1966 to 1969. Location, Korean Demilitarized Zone. Casualties and losses. South Korea had, during the period, had 299 killed, 550 wounded. The United States. Had 43 killed, 111 wounded. North Korean casualties were estimated to be 397 killed, 12 soldiers, and 2,462 quote unquote agents captured in the South. What are we talking about here? And so Vietnam's going on, and people are getting killed in Korea. And the North Koreans would infiltrate through the DMZ and then conduct ambushes. And so as part of that, you know, the technique at the time that was being used in Vietnam and now in Korea was Agent Orange. We'll defoliate the son of a bitch, and they won't be able to, we'll deny them the use of that concealment. So you can hear the interview I did yesterday on Mac Talk and with Ralph Kingsbury. And he's a farmer. He's an economist. He's served in various capacities in state government, on the State Board of Higher Education, things like that. Just a smart guy. And when they found out that he might be exposed, there was a young girl at the VA who said, no, we're gonna file this paperwork. And he said, no, I don't need anything from the government. And she said, no, you're entitled to it. And he kept pushing back, no. And this is, again, the kind of people that you find that serve and then go on to live good lives. I don't need that. And it's one of the most humbling interviews I've ever done. So you'll hear about his how he gets in the Army. And his story was, I think, 4F. But he went down and enlisted. All right, so from yesterday. Ralph Kingsbury, with incredible, I'm incredibly humbled to play this. You're listening to Mac Talk on the All World Radio Network. How about that? I whipped some Tupac on him. He was probably listening, thinking, what the hell did I get? McNair has lost his mind. It is a good bumper, though. 158. Snow in the region, so if you're going to be out and about driving, be careful. Ralph Kingsbury with us. Ralph, do you have a solution? Do you have a solution to this? I mean, as you said, you know, the basis for Macy's evaluation.
Let me find the point.
When mall
holding tournament and stay at a motel, you pay a set degree with. And when I say about I had economic type jobs, I was the first full-time director of institutional research at UND back in 1967, and I went back there and started my graduate work, and I was doing for my basic, in Fort Ord, California.
All right, hold on.
My AIT.
Now we're talking
about at the time what was called the volunteer draft, which meant 1967, and I was at UND. I graduated with my bachelor's in Sigma Mac, they joined the Marines, the tough ones, going on, around the world.
Right.
And the last thing the Army wanted was somebody like...
Your experience as a veteran.
All right, here we are.
Long time person of note here in the region and in the state of North Dakota.
All right, with apologies. I forgot that there was the economic development discussion. Actually, it's about taxes. A store in North Dakota, property taxes, right? So Macy's moved out, and they own the piece of the mall that they that their store had been in. It was assessed; the assessed value was $6 million. It sold for $400,000. I think Macy's wants some of their money back. That's that whole assessed value. You know, not based on real prices because it's not turning over. But anyway, and one of the reasons, you think if they were paying their taxes on $400,000, they might still be there? Possibly. Anyway, I digress. Okay, so now you hear the military part of the interview.
I just I don't understand stuff, and I just scratch my head, honestly, Ralph, and looking at this. It didn't seem like there was the way ahead was clear, and certainly the financial hurdles that communities have dealt with certainly don't speak well relative to what came out of the legislature. But I want to switch gears. I want to talk about your experience as a veteran. First of all, you know, how did the Army get on your horizon? How did you wind up in the Army?
Okay. I was born in 1943, and when I became 18, which was 61, there was still the draft. And so everybody had to register for all the boys had to register for the draft. And I did that. Now, I had had some minor health problems. And to make a long story short, the doctor said, I think maybe you're developing an ulcer, but it's not anything very serious. I said, fine. I submitted that to the Army, and in 61, 62, nothing was really going on, you know, around the world.
Right.
And the last thing the Army wanted was somebody like me that might cost them some kind of medical expense. And so they classified me 4F, and we used to all joke about that, which was a medical deferment. And then, of course, Vietnam started. And about 66, 67, and I was at UND. I graduated with my bachelor's in 65, and then I went back there and started my graduate work, and I was doing this teaching and everything else, and I was really enjoying it. But I watched guys I know drop out of college and join the services, and in particular, Matt, they joined the Marines, the tough ones. Some of them didn't come home.
Right.
And I just then saw guys that graduated, and they went through ROTC, and they were second Louis and all that, and they were going to Vietnam. And I just had not had any problems. And I couldn't sit there and let my friends do this and me hide behind something that I didn't think was valid. The head of the draft board was a mother of a friend of mine, and so I went to her and I said, are you going to re-examine? And of course, she didn't know all of this. She said, I would guess that they are going to call you for a re-examination. And so I said, well, when do you think that would be? And she said, well, sometime within the next year. Now, this is getting to be late 67 or so. And so I said, why don't you take me now and down to the AC station? Let's see what happens. And I knew at the time that things were getting pretty tough and they were really needing people. I said, I imagine if you walk in the AC station, you'll be 1-8. And we kind of laughed, yeah, that's probably it. Well, guess what? I walked in the AFE station, and I walked out that night, and I was 1-8. So now I go back to her, and I said, so when do you think you would draft me? And again, we don't really know. It depends on what they call for. It depends on how many more troops they decide to send over there, and it depends on, all these different types of things. And I said, yeah, I understand, but best guess? And she said, best guess, it'd be January. So this is now April of 68, and they had at the time what was called the volunteer draft, which meant, you acknowledge you were going to get drafted, and rather than wait till they did it and all this, how would I try to get a job? I was going to graduate, in June of 68, and that time it was a June graduation. And so what am I going to do? As far as trying to get a job, how do I tell a guy, I want a job from him, but by the way, I'll probably get drafted and, I won't do you any good. So anyway, I said, when does the July draft go? And she said, 9th of July. And I said, that works out just perfect. I said, I'll graduate first part of June. I'll have all of June and the 4th of July weekend off, and then I'll go in the Army. So I said, let me sign up for the volunteer draft for July of 68. And that's what we did. And then I went to Fort Lewis, Washington for my basic, and Fort Ord, California for my AIT. And it was interesting. I was pulled over for 10 days. So I saw the people that graduated the week before me. Everybody went to Vietnam. The people that graduated the week after me, everybody went to Vietnam. But as we talked about the other day, there was a lot going on in Korea that you didn't know about at the press, and they needed more people over there. And the week I graduated, only 20% of the guys went to Vietnam. About 20% stayed at Orton for about 6 months, and the rest of us got sent to Korea. And I got stationed at the headquarters of the 7th Infantry Division at what was called Camp, and it's still there, Camp Casey, Korea. And that's north of Seoul, and it's really, we sat on the DMZ. Now, technically, I wasn't on the DMZ. That was a couple miles north of me. But we supported the guys on the DMZ. And there were times I would do things like I would ride shotgun, you called it, and I did it with a couple South Korean troops. And we would go up to the camps that were right on the line with supplies, you know, and different things like that. And that was, you know, so then I came home and then anybody, oh, you went to Korea, you were really lucky. Well, in the 14 months that I was in Korea, I suppose in my division, there were, there's a question as whether that airplane that got shot down had a double crew on it or not. They never would tell us that, but there were somewhere between 50 and 70 guys that were killed.
In that airplane?
No, in total.
Oh, between 50 and 70?
There were really only about...
Wow.
Say again.
Between 50 and 70 guys, just to give everybody some kind of reference for a number in a regiment, which is about a, which is about 5,000 Marines, 300 of them, it's about 5,000 Marines, 3,000, would be, frontline combat troops. In that size group, we sustained somewhere between 60 and 70 casualties. Killed in action in Afghanistan. So, so you had a similar number, for, albeit a larger group, but it's not an insignificant number when you're talking about the fact that there's not supposed to be a war going on.
And that's right. And again, not to take a lot of time to explain all of that to everybody, but
hey,
basically that's
you,
right.
Ralph, take your time. We're going nowhere. All right, this is I want to talk about this because it's not something that you know it's not something we talk about a whole lot, right?
Well, I want you to understand. Nobody ever shot at me. I never saw that, but. When I was riding that shotgun guard on that deuce and a half, we went out on these roads, and they were just gravel roads and up and around the mountains. And they were bad enough that this is a minor thing, but and that, this guy isn't included in the 50 to 70, but a mailman, the guy that was delivering mail to one of the outposts, went off one of these roads and rolled down the mountain. I mean, it wasn't a super highway. You know, that we were driving on is what I'm trying to tell you. We were out in the boonies and things were like that. So anyway, I go out on this road and about 6 to 8 weeks later, the signal battalion was located right next to where I was and they got this message that between these two camps there wasn't, the communications weren't working. Go out there and find out what the trouble is. And they went out on that same road. And they found these wires cut. And maybe they should have known better at the time, but they weren't. They were supposed to fix them. And they got out of their truck to fix them. And the North Koreans came out of the brush. And they killed all four of them. I mean, these guys didn't have any kind of weapons with them or anything else. You know, it was just a massacre. It was just a slaughter. There were quite a few guys that as they call it, walk the wire, which means right on, you know, if you know how the DMC is set up, and there's the wire, and then on this side, I'm on this side, and you're on that side, you know, and things like that. And they would walk, and they would get into what you know, we call firefights.
Right.
With North Koreans.
Now again, this is all the back and forth at the DMZ in 1960, what year?
Well, starting in 66 through about 70, there was so much of this going on that the people that have written about it referred to it as the Second Korean War.
Wow. Because when you mentioned that number to me yesterday, I thought I was stunned. I was blown away by that. I had no idea, and I'm a reader of military history, you know, Ralph, and there isn't much written about it because I looked it up on the internet. You'll see it referred to as either the Second Korean War, the Korean DMZ conflict. You'll also see the DMZ war. You'll see, and I again, it's something that you know that I didn't know about. And then I'll just read a little bit about it. It was a series of low-level armed clashes between North Korean forces and the forces of South Korea and the United States, largely occurring between 1966 and 1969 at adjacent to the DMZ. And you look at, you know, the hills and the fortifications. You look at the, you know, the infiltration stuff that the North Koreans would try to do. And you're looking at it going, holy smokes, man. I mean, it was on there. And you better have your ass and your brain wired together or you're going to get dead. And so it's just amazing. Let me ask you a couple questions about it. I assume that the South Koreans were not infiltrating into North Korea. I'll assume that the incursions were from the north to the south. Would most of them be simply by infantry soldiers that were infiltrating and then they would ambush somebody? Describe what would be a typical fight.
Well, you got it right. They would come across. They would, and of course, one thing you look for, these guys that were walking the wire, was for a cut wire. You know, I mean, it was supposed to be solid, and then they'd come to a spot, and the wire had been cut. Well, they knew what had happened. The North Koreans came across. Now, sometimes they never found any North Koreans on the south side. They apparently, through the extent that they had any kind of intelligence, understood that some of the North Koreans would finish their school, and their graduation exercise was to go to the south and bring something back to prove that they had done it. So sometimes they weren't looking for a firefight. Sometimes they were just looking to prove that they could do that, get across and find, you know, steal something and bring it back to prove that they were able to do that. I don't know if you had read about the number of tunnels that they still are finding yet today.
I didn't get that.
North Korean big tunnels. I mean, one, and again, this has been too long, I can't tell you for sure, but how quickly they could get a division through one of these tunnels.
That's been
in the middle of the night, they could get a whole division in the South Korea with no problem at all. We didn't find them.
Right, that's been a long discussed, topic relative to North Korea and war on the Korean Peninsula. You'll hear it spoken about today. There's ground penetrating radar. There's all kinds of things that we use today. But there's not to say that the Koreans have had a long time to prepare for this. And, the problem is at some point you have to mass troops to get them together to go. And if you do that against the United States, you'll get dead because we have, whether it be satellites or aviation,
You know, and it would, a war on the Korean Peninsula now would be certainly a bloody affair, but their Air Force is not going to take on the United States Air Force, United States Navy, and Marine Air. They'll lose. And again, we may lose. We may get a few teeth knocked out and our nose broken, but they're going to die. And once you establish that air superiority, then it's an unfair fight. And so, my point in saying that is when these things begin to happen, you know, in order to infiltrate those troops, I know they try to keep them spread out and they would move through very quickly, but you still got to get those guys all together somehow and you got to get them adjacent to the border, and that leaves some kind of signature for a country like the United States. So, I know there's great, and the North Koreans, the last time that something like this happened in the United States was on the Korean Peninsula, and it was in 1950 in the winter, as the 1st Marine Division, who's out here at Camp Pendleton, and the 8th Army were headed north. I think it was the 18th Corps headed north towards the Chinese border, and they were going to be home for Christmas. And the Chinese, don't ask me how, but they snuck, you know, hundreds of thousands of troops and essentially surprised the Army and the Marine Corps. And in fact, you arguably the Marine Corps' greatest hour is the fight that they have from what's a place called the Chosin Reservoir, yes, to the east.
I know it.
To the east coast of the Korean Peninsula, essentially surrounded. And it's just an incredible, incredible fight. And so interesting stuff. Ralph Kingsbury, go ahead.
You know who the Army unit was that stood there with the Marines at Tosun? It was my 7th Infantry Division.
Wow, was it?
When I say mine, I mean, people don't know that. The pride I have in having been a member of the 7th Infantry Division is because of things like Tosun Reservoir. I mean, their history. The 7th Infantry Division was at Fort Ord, and as soon as Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, they were immediately sent to the Pacific. They were the ones that were at, why can't I think of it now, that Henderson Field,
yes,
and whatever. That was, you know, I think that was the 7th. And anyway, then at the end of the war, they were the occupying force for Korea. Until 1949, they sent them to Japan. And then, of course, in June of 50, the war started, and they were MacArthur's troops on the Incheon Landing. It was the 7th Infantry Division. And then when I say we, they stayed there, and I became part of that until 1970. And in 1970, finally, after leaving Fort Ord in 1941, or maybe it was 42 by the time I got out of Ord, but from 1942 until 1970, the 7th Infantry Division was never home.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's an amazing story. And the fight in Korea, I mean, that was a tough fight. You had people that wanted to fight, and the fight around the Chosin Reservoir, I mean, the Chinese had marched from, you know, China. They had walked. When you look at the number of casualties that the Chinese, if you compare the 1st Marine Division, which they were, what they were attempting to do with the 7th Division and the 1st Marine Division is annihilate them, right? China wanted the headline that these storied infantry units that had fought so nobly in World War II had been destroyed,
yep,
by the Chinese. But the Chinese weren't well supplied logistically. Not all their troops had weapons. And when the Marines got in a circle, and elements of the 7th Division did as well, and they fought, organized, and used air and artillery, the Chinese could not sustain the kind of pressure that they would have needed to do to destroy those units. And then... You know, the weather got to be between 20 and 40 below at night, and the Chinese were dying of exposure. You had guys walking around barefoot,
And I was watching a video a couple of weeks ago when I did an interview about the Chosen Reservoir, and it's stunning to look at, you know, to look at the condition of Chinese soldiers. And if you look at the statistics, the number that died of exposure and malnutrition related exposure are astronomical.
You know, this DNA stuff, it was just recently that a couple Marines were found, and it's funny, all the trouble we have with North Korea, they still are turning over bodies that they're finding from the war. When I say bodies, I mean it might be just some bones or whatever. And the DNA, you know, with some families, they've been able to identify some of those remains.
Yeah, again, and the repatriation of those remains, you see more and more. They just disinterred 400 sets of remains from the punch bowl in Hawaii, where they buried survivors, the guys who died in like the USS Oklahoma, the USS Pennsylvania, and those guys, they weren't able to identify. Well, now they've disinterred, and they believe they'll identify 90% of the remains. Pretty amazing.
It is
pretty amazing.
It is really something.
Now I want to, Ralph, talk about you know Agent Orange. That's now a part of your life story. When did Agent Orange first cross your bow? When did you first hear about it? When did you think that maybe that might be something that was impacting your life?
Well, of course I had my first heart attack when I was 42. And I recovered from it, if that's the right term. I farmed until I was about 64 or 3 or something like that. When I developed spinal stenosis so bad that I just couldn't move anymore, and I finally had to quit farming. And I never thought anything, and of course we hadn't even heard of Agent Orange maybe at that point. And we make this story because it gets a little long and involved and not to take up too much of the time. But anyway, I happened to be talking to my local veteran service officer about a totally unrelated thing. And so I was telling him, and he was a guy who had been in what I refer to as in the sand. You know, he had been over to, whether it was Iraq or whichever war it was over there that he was fighting. But anyway, so then I was telling him my experience, and then I told him, you know, about my life and about my heart attack. He said, you were in Korea at what time? And I told him, and you had a heart attack?
Yeah.
He said, the Department of Defense, and this is about 4 years ago now, has just admitted they used Agent Orange in parts of Korea. And so what it comes down to is if you were in Korea between, I think it was 66 and 69, again, in that period of time, and were stationed north of Seoul, which of course I was, obviously, and had certain illnesses, of which there were three or four, as I recall, different cancers, and what's called ischemic heart disease. A heart attack, an ischemic type of heart attack, you would be eligible to apply for an Agent Orange disability. Well, I actually was having so much trouble at that point, and things were happening that I didn't understand to myself. And so I wasn't getting things done like he told me I should. And then he got another job with the VA in Fargo, so he went down there. And we had a young girl from Walsh County who had also been in the sand. She was a guard member and had been activated and sent over there. And she called me one day. I was just sitting here. And she said, I was going through these records. We're going to do this, Ralph. I said, well, no. She said, I'm not going to let you buy this because we're going to do this. So she did it. I mean, did all the paperwork for me. I just can't say enough good about this girl. And I call her a girl. I mean, I'm sure she's probably still in her 20s. And so she filled out all the papers. And submitted them. And this was getting to be April of this past year. Now, and it's in this year, April of now, and it wasn't 2 months and I got a notification. You know, and Basically it said, get down to Fargo, we're going to do this exam on you. And I did, and they did the exam. And the doctor that was the head doctor, and I think he's a cardiologist, said, you know, I've seen a lot of this, he said, and he said, I'm going to tell you, your heart has amazing pumping power, and it's a good thing it does, because that ischemic heart attack has essentially destroyed your heart. And if you didn't have that pumping power, he said, you'd be dead now.
Living that good outdoor life as a farmer.
Yeah. So anyway, they gave me a 40% disability. Some people have tried to tell me to get more. Well, I told them I wasn't out, you know, to get more.
He's got Agent Orange in his body that's killing him. And you gave him 40% disabled. I think sleep apnea gets you 80 or something like that. You know, I try not to hate on the VA, but God damn it, man. And listen to this. Now he's going to, he starts talking about how he doesn't hold any grudges. It's just, I get emotional at one point coming up here that I can't talk, and he hops in and he talks. But this is Ralph Kingsbury, veteran of the Army. And talking about finding about that the Army had used Agent Orange in Korea, and that he had it.
I appreciate, you know, and again, as I told you yesterday, they were trying to help us. I mean, these guys were coming through that brush and shooting American soldiers, and so they sprayed the brush so that they didn't have any place to hide. And if you look at some pictures of Camp Casey, there's a couple, you know, we're surrounded by all the mountains, the hills right around it, and there's a couple of lines coming down, and it's a power line, and they sprayed underneath those power lines, and there's nothing growing there. I mean, that's how much they sprayed. There's nothing growing there, and also right beside it, that ran right behind the hooch I lived in, and also the hooch I worked in just a block away, is a stream or a river, because I mean it flows up pretty much all the time. It comes down out of those damn hills, and of course it went through all that stuff and, you know, picked up all that Agent Orange and brought it down past us. And I've never seen statistics on how many of the people that were there with me. I have two or three websites that I'm on, and a couple of them are Agent Orange websites, and I know that a lot of people have had the problem. A couple of them I happen to know, were the same company I was in and everything. I didn't know those guys, but I have, you know, so I mean, this happened to people, and we knew it.
Okay.
And
well, so, I want to ask you the human side of this. I don't know that I would be, that I would take any of that as well. You know, and you say they were trying to do good things, but, I mean, ultimately, I mean, you had a heart attack when you were young, you know, and Agent Orange doesn't get better with age. Put it in some kind of context for us in terms of your feelings relative to, to all of this. Because, you know, I'd be mad, you know. I'd be mad if that happened to me, and so how do you deal with that?
You know, I have neighbors, some back to World War II that I was too young, who came home in those pine boxes.
Right.
One guy came home. In Korea, his brother came home in a pine box. And they are essentially next-door neighbors. And I knew some of the, there's about three or four guys that came home from Vietnam like that. And like I told you, when I sat there in the shirt being, you know, college was pretty nice. Yeah. Things were pretty good. The one guy that I know was from up by Crosby. He quit to join the Marines. Got his leg blown off. His mother and dad got out to California, wherever it was they took him. Just in time to hold his hand before he died.
So are you going to
do something like that?
You going to tell me that you're one of the lucky ones?
Sure. Absolutely, I am. Right. And, you know, our country tried to do the right thing. And, you know, in Korea, they did the right thing. I mean, if you're reading anything and you see what Korea, South Korea is today, those guys, those neighbors of mine that I still sit next to in the cafe and that, and they're getting pretty old now, but just imagine what they accomplished. Now, that's not what happened in Vietnam. Because we didn't do it right. And, you know, when we were talking the other day, I said, you know, Ike and people like that knew what to do about Korea. And, of course, at the time, we were so powerful, and we were the only one that powerful. You know, we could do those things. I mean, I said, you're going to do this, or I'm going to drop atomic bombs. And they forget when Trump talks today, but the problem is North Korea has atomic bombs now, too. In those days, we were the only ones that could do that.
Right.
But we had dropped them on Japan, and they believed we would do it if they didn't do what we told them. But, you know, we did the right things in the terms of we made it stop, and then we made sure that South Korea stayed free. And look at what South Korea is today.
You know what, but you know what, in hindsight, MacArthur's mistake is unforgivable. What he did by not doing the due diligence, and they had reports that the Chinese were moving. When you read the intelligence assessment of what happened in Korea, there were people saying that, hey, the Chinese are moving. And no, the Chinese will not enter this. You know, they know we have nuclear weapons. It'd be a slaughter, blah, blah, blah. It was arrogance, you know, very reminiscent of Donald Rumsfeld in Iraq. And just an arrogant jerk. And that destabilization, that failure, MacArthur's failure, we're still being punished for it. Because if they would have taken that seriously and they would have stopped their advance, and the majority of the Korean Peninsula, you know, would have been owned by the South Korean government. And we would not be doing this dance that we are today. That border would have been the border with China, and it would be so arrogance is a bad thing. Let me ask you, how do you live with Agent Orange?
Well, you know, I told you some of my problems, including how bad this lymphedema has been, and the doctor said this spinal stenosis. He said, we never trace it this far. He said, but I have no doubt that it's related to this whole problem because your blood just never circulated properly, you know, and everything else. And he said, that's just what it is. And he just said, I can't tell you anything else, Ralph. He said, it's really something that you're still alive, and it's really... You know, I mean, this is just the way it is. And so, like I say, some people are telling me, oh, you do this, and you could get 60%, or you can do, you know, whatever. And I said, that's not what this is about. You know, I'm not after money because, you know, if I die, I won't do any good. And my family will be taken care of under it, you know, and they're just so... And I just hesitate to say this, but I don't know how else to say it. I just am proud to be an American. And I know we made some mistakes. And I know we do some things wrong. And I'm not very happy with the political situation today with many people. Not just Trump. I'm not happy with the president, but I'm not happy with many of the Democrats either. It's not the people of the time, and I keep going back to this, that was such a good friend with Reagan, the Democrat.
Tip O'Neill.
Yeah, Tip O'Neill. I mean, that's what politics was, to me, about and supposed to be about. And look at what they got accomplished for this country at the time because of the kinds of people they were. And that's the kind of politics I want to see yet today. If we had a country like that, you know, how great it would be. And I'm just hoping that we can get through all this and get back to that type of thing sometime, at some point, you know. So, like I said, I'm a patriot. I don't know how else to say it. And I think we owe it to our country. It won't be a country if we're not willing to do some of these things. And, you know, I'm 74 years old, and my mother died when she was 68. And I had an uncle die young. I mean, lots of people don't get to live as long as I do. And this country did give me a lot. My family gave me a lot, you know. I mean, all this type of thing. And the state was good. I mean, all this, I had a good life. And what else, you know, what would be accomplished by being mad?
I guess the question is, you're right. Nothing. It wouldn't change anything. But I hear you talk, Ralph, and as somebody, you and I have the same experiences, in our lives. You know, we've gone away from our homes and we fought for our countries. We've seen, you know, the best and brightest of our country, selfishly fight and go to the aid of comrades when they shouldn't. We've seen them killed. We've seen that. And then the cherry on top is years later you find out that you've been poisoned. And again, I understand, and I believe you're right. They were trying to do, you know, they were trying to do the right, good, something good, you know, but it just seems like an awfully high price to pay. And again, I say that, but I'm not paying the price. You know, you guys like you are. And again, and Agent Orange is not a small problem around the country. In the Vietnam veteran community, in the Korean War veteran community, it's a huge problem. And it seemed, you know, just, you know, with both those groups who were not treated like the World War II vets, you know, got treated. It's been amazing to me to hear from Korean War vets and Vietnam vets that they heard the same thing from World War II vets. You candy asses, you can go over there and kick their ass. What's wrong with you? And so, and you hear that, you're like, what? Yeah, oh yeah. Oh yeah. That's another reason I don't, that's another reason I don't go to the VFW. Wow. Ralph, the only thing I can say is, first of all, one, thank you for the history lesson in a part of, something that I certainly didn't know a lot about. And, it's guys like you that have set a great example for me that I, in turn, try to set for my two sons that are both officers in the Marine Corps. And hopefully they will set for their sons who God only knows what they will do. And it is what makes this country great, that we have people like you, like me, like my sons, like the Papes from East Grand Forks who had two of their sons killed on active duty and the third one in the Army who's now farming north of East Grand Forks. But it's those kind of young people that go off and do our fighting. But I just want to commend you for your selfless spirit relative to your nation's errors, because I don't know that I'd feel the same way. I don't know that I would react the same way, even though it might not change anything. I might be a little bit more pissed off than you are.
Well, and of course, things that help me are my family. And, you know, I've got four kids, my wife, and, you know, and it's been great. And they just, they keep me on the straight and narrow. I would like to see one thing. I've got a couple different websites, but one of them, I tried to separate my politics from my personal stuff, and I've got a website just in my name that shows pictures of my grandkids and everything else, but where I want to say things about stuff and stuff like this, I want to, it's called My Life and Times, Ralph Kingsbury. And I'll post things on there that I don't post on my personal one. And I just posted something yesterday, and take a time, take a look at it, because it's open, anybody can get in there. But what it is, and I saw it from somebody else, and I, you know, I shared it, but it was an army exercise, and there must be five or six, I think C-5As or whatever they are, they're full of parachute guys, you know, and they're jumping on me. It's only an exercise. It wasn't in a war, and I assumed it was probably down in Georgia or someplace like that. But then I wrote on there, you know, these millennials, you know, they ask for everything. They don't do anything. I mean, all they want to do is jump out of airplanes and go over to the sand, you know, and protect us from the terrorists. Right. In the meantime, we take away the interest deduction on their student loans. Well, in fact, I read that that's one thing that did stay in there. So if that's the case, fine. They finally did that part right. But then I just said, in the meantime, you guys, there's nothing else to do. Just jump. Jump, guys, out of the airplane. There's nothing else for you to do right now, you know. And just think of what those guys, you know, we talked a little bit yesterday about the volunteer service versus the draft and everything. Just imagine not one of those guys and women today have to expose themselves for that, but they do it. Just think what they're doing, you know.
You know, it's the finest spirit of the country. It's the most noble of the country. And to go with them, to watch them, to be a part of it, is the greatest experience of my life, certainly. And I would imagine your time in Korea doing that is one of the greatest experiences of yours. I'll tell you a funny airborne story. When I went to Iraq in 2004, we were in western part of Iraq. The 82nd Airborne had actually gone from Afghanistan to Iraq, and was kind of a placeholder before we got to Al Anbar province, where Fallujah, Ramadi, very bad places like that were. And so we're doing the relief with them, the relief in place with them. And you know, there's such a storied organization. I'll never forget the first night that we got to their base. We were, we must have got there at midnight or something. And we threw our stuff in the hooch where we were going to live. And then we walked down the street to their command post. And we come around the corner, and here is the big AA, that they have. They wear, that is their patch. But it's on this, the sign had to be 20 feet by 20 feet, hanging above the entrance, and it had lights on it. And you walked down the corner and you saw that. And if you have any sense of history of what the 82nd Airborne has done throughout, you know, American military history, it gave you chills. And so I met a bunch of those guys working as we did the turnover. And they told really funny stories. One of the stories would be, you know, they said, you know, we'd come home from Afghanistan or, you know, a lot of us had jumped in Panama. Some of us jumped in Desert Storm. You know, so you have guys with 6, 7, 8 combat jumps. And we'll be at a reunion for the 82nd Airborne. And these old guys will come up to you and say, hey, how many combat jumps you got there, trooper? And they'll say, sir, I've got 9. Really? And then he said they act really interested. Where were they? And they said, oh, this one was here, and this one was here, and this one was here, this one's here. And then the kid will say, did you make any combat jumps, sir? And these guys would say, I only made 2. And you know, the young guy will look at him and say, where were they? Normandy and Market Garden. You ever hear of them?
Yeah.
He said these guys would start laughing, and they'd slap this kid on the back. Keep it up, boy. We're watching you. But he said, you know, they used to lure us in like that, and it was just hilarious. And, but again, just the greatest experience of a lifetime. Ralph Russo, I can't thank you enough for talking about this.
I wanted to have you on and have this discussion, and because I'd never really heard about that, and you're probably the first person I've ever interviewed that we've discussed Agent Orange, and just want to tell you thoughts and prayers certainly with you as you kind of go through it, and I hope you don't mind if I give you a call and maybe we do this again and talk about that period of time again, because I'm very fascinated by it, and you sound like you have more information to give.
Well, I mean, I certainly would be willing to talk to you again. I just want to say that I just want to be careful. I mean, there were guys who did way more than I did. You know, I got exposed to that. This happened to me and everything else. But, I mean, there were guys with rifles in their hands and went out there and did some awful, you know, hard things, Mike. And I don't know what all you got involved with, but I just have nothing but respect. I mean, you know, the type of thing that you guys did over there, and again, as I call it, in the sand and that, I mean, you just never knew who you know, who your friend was and who the guy was that was ready to kill you.
Well, Ralph, really, I would tell you that Iraq was a tougher place. Afghanistan, you know, they had planted IEDs, but Iraq, they had the suicide bombers with cars in vests, and they came from any different direction. They would use a distractor. They would use a distractor before they did it, and they were good at it. They knew how to get close to you, and they watched you and watched you. And, you know, in Iraq, I learned that nothing is a coincidence. If you're seeing it, it's because they want you to see it, because they're shaping your lens, and then they're going to use it against you. And that was really hard, and a lot of civilians got killed because of it, because if a car didn't stop, you had to assume that it was trying to kill you. And so it was just really tough mentally. But I will say this, when we get into a fight, we know they're going to die. You know, you guys fought a formidable guys that were willing to come and fight and were good. The you know, the guys that we've fought they're not good soldiers. They're not well trained. They're well motivated, but once you lock horns with them, unless they have you surrounded and outnumbered, you're gonna kill them. And so, I think that's a big difference. A big difference.
Yeah, I understand.
All right. Well, sir, first of all, no, thank you for doing this today, and I thoroughly enjoyed it, Ralph. And I need to have you on a more regular basis, because I enjoyed you explaining these things in more detail than I think I do. And then I think I'm better as a second than a first. So thank you very much for doing this today.
I just want to add one thing. I've got and I call them second and third cousins, but our dads and mothers were cousins. But anyway, he's a Marine, and he's been over in the sand, and he's back again. And I mean, I'm just, you know, I email, especially his mother. She's the one that's my age, and they're so happy that anybody recognizes this. And that's the only thing I would ask, like any of your listeners, understand what these, and I'll say it, these kids are doing for us. And don't forget them, and you know, buy them a cup of coffee if you see them or something like that. Even, you know, even the guard guy that's in there. I mean, these guys are putting their life on the line for us. And don't forget about them. And tell them thank you. I started wearing a cap. Now I'm a 7th Division Veterans cap. There are people that walk by me, and somebody will say, thanks for your service. You don't understand what that means to somebody when you've been through something and they don't know, you know, the whole story, but the fact that somebody would even say that. So don't forget when you see one of these guys to tell them something like that. That's all I would ask.
I say this to guys who fought in Vietnam. We get treated completely different now because of the way Vietnam guys got treated. And so people do take the time. My son and I were just talking the other day, and I was telling him, I said, you know, there's a, when we would come back on leave from Afghanistan, you fly in from Kuwait, you fly either to Atlanta International, what is it, Hartsfield Airport, or Dallas Fort Worth, and there's one, I think I flew into Dallas, and there's one ramp that we were the only ones that use, and it empties into the airport. When you come down, and there was a group of us, and we came down, people stop, and I get emotional talk about it. And they applaud.
Yes. I've seen that, you know, on TV. And it is. I mean, just...
And then you go in to buy a Coke or a sandwich, and you know somebody says, I'll pay for that. And so, wherever I go speak, I always the first things I do is ask if there's any Vietnam veterans, stand up and say, on behalf of everybody who served today, thank you for what you did, thank you for what you went through, because we don't get treated like that anymore. We get treated, Ralph, like you're talking about. If you're in uniform, you know, people have a respect for that, and if they know somehow or other have learned that you fought, they have incredible respect for that. And again, it's because it still befuddles me how a nation so consumed with peace and love in the 60s could turn its back on its warriors, the guys who went and fought, and then they had to suffer alone for so long. I don't get that about the hippies and all of that. Like, how did that make sense to you that you could treat them so cruelly? They were just young people like you were. They very much like you, Ralph, that generation, they were born in the 40s, right? When they went to grammar school and they played sports in high school, everybody who coached them, most of their teachers were all veterans. They lived in this world of veteran post World War II life, and then guys like you, you know, through Korea happened the first time, and you read the newspapers and watched it and heard veterans talking about it and all that kind of stuff, and for guys like you, and then when Vietnam and Korea roll around, or when it came your turn, like you talked about the anxiety you had, the guys are going over, and you're not. Like, in that culture, in that, you know, that you grew up in, you know, how do you walk around that guy, there's a war going on, and I didn't go? How do you walk around your town in that culture? You know? I'd imagine guys ask you, hey, how come you're not in the Army? Straight up asking. So.
Yep. Yeah, we were at a pizza place one time, and we'd been at a party, and the guy was a friend of mine, but he was wearing a flower in his hair, you know, and it was kind of a joke, and these two guys walked up to him, and I didn't think we were going to get out of there, because they had been over there, and they thought this friend of mine was a hippie, you know, and you know what, boy, they weren't going to take us. And he was just sitting there, my friend, and finally I said, hey, you know, we were at a party. I said, he's gone, he's going to go, and I'm going to go, you know, and all this type of stuff. We were just at a party, and just kind of, you know, relaxed and things. But I didn't blame those guys. I mean, I could imagine what, you know, they'd been there, and they probably were, you know, frontline troops and seen their friends die, you know, and everything else. And then they saw somebody they thought was just a hippie, and they didn't have any love for him, you know. So, well, Mac, I've taken a lot of your time.
No, let me just tell you, there's a reason this has gone on, and it's because I've thoroughly enjoyed it. So, Ralph, first of all, thank you for coming on and doing this. And Merry Christmas to you and all of yours, and God bless you. And thank you very much for doing this.
And the same to you. Thank you, Mac.
All right, bud. Have a good one.
Bye.
That is one of the most unselfish things I have ever heard in my life. And if you think about that, can you imagine the news when you get somebody looks you in the face and says, you have Agent Orange inside your body? That's a death sentence for many. And his response is, there are people that had it way worse than I did. That's a man right there. That's a straight up man. And God bless him. And I don't know if we as a culture appreciate guys like Ralph Kingsbury enough. We can never say thank you enough, too much, to guys like him. And then to be so good natured, even keeled about that, it just blows me away. So that'll do it for, okay, that was the interview we did yesterday. And again, just sitting here listening to it today, he's got Agent Orange, and he didn't talk about physically, you know, what he's going through, but it isn't pleasant. I mean, his body's being destroyed. And yet he has that, say thank you to veterans. People have it worse than me. Some guys didn't come back. Just very humbling to listen to him yesterday. All right, we're going to take a break. Montana Man's going to join us. More of All-Marine Radio coming up next right here on the All-Warrior Radio Network. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military, for a first responder, for a hunter, for an outdoorsman, or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. battlemug.com.